Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Rise of Justice Movement podcast. My name is Zachary Mallory, and I am the host of the Rise of Justice Movement podcast. Today, I will give a viewer discretion as advised due to the nature of the topics that we were discussing. Today, I am joined by my friend and the Chief Executive Officer of Callisto, Tracy. Welcome to the Rise of Justice Movement podcast.
Thank you so much for having me here.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's jump right in. And what got you into doing the work to end sexual and gender-based violence?
Yeah, that's always a really interesting question because I've been doing this work for 25 years. It seems like a lifetime. Well, I mean, I guess it is a lifetime, but it seems so quick and so long at all at the same time. I have always wanted to help people, and I really didn't know what I wanted to do with that. And in college, I got an internship working with adolescent boys in a group home. And what I realized is that many of them were victims and some of them were perpetrators. And I went on to get a master's of social work and I started working with adolescent sex offenders. And when I did, people would always ask me, why are you working with adolescent sex offenders? Like, and they were locked up, but I was still providing treatment for them. And it was because if you can stop offenders, particularly adolescents, at a young age, which recidivism was like 6 to 15% at that time, you can stop assaults from even happening. And as I continued to do that work, more and more people, as soon as I said what I did in just casual conversation, they would tell me their stories and they would say, I've never said this to anybody else. And so I quickly realized the breadth of this issue, having been a woman myself and also, just having really dear and close friends that have experienced sexual assault and rape. And I knew that I had to keep going with it. And so I've been doing this work in some capacity of either helping victims and survivors or helping to treat offenders or to get men involved in the conversation to really talk about the culture and rape culture and how it all supports that and how the joke connects to the bruise. And I've just been doing that for a long time because it's so needed.
It is incredibly needed, and I think it's incredible about the work that Callisto is doing, to end that serial sexual assault, because Callisto is one of the only organizations in the world that's actually doing like this cutting edge technology and utilizing technology in the most positive way in a world of like AI, in a world of like all of everything that's going on right now. I think it's incredibly important to highlight the work that Callisto is doing. So walk us through what Callisto is and how it got started.
Yeah, so we were founded in 2013 by Jess Ladd, and she was a survivor of campus sexual assault. And she wanted to figure out how we could end it. And so she built Callisto in 2013, or started the idea of Callisto in 2013, to address this using technology. And she looked at it from a really epidemiological approach. And she found out that 90% of serial or 90% of campus sexual assaults are committed by serial perpetrators who on average offend 6 times while in college. And so if you do the math of that and you can stop a perpetrator after 2 assaults, which is too many, it reduces campus sexual assault by 59%. And right now, survivors have no way of finding out if they're the only one. So, our technology has evolved, as all tech does, throughout that time. And so, what we do now is that anybody in the US and its territories with a .edu email address has free access. So whether they're a student, a professor, a staff member at a university, they have free access. And if they want to know if their perpetrators harm somebody else, they create an account. And what they do is they enter into matching, which requires them to put the state where the assault occurred. And that is because sexual assault laws vary by state. And then they put in a unique identifier of their perpetrator. And that's what we use to match on. So they would put in a social media handle, email address, phone number, whatever it is that they know, as many as they know. And so if 2 people put in the same Instagram account, let's say, there's going to be a match. It's not a dating site, so they're not going to find out that there's a match right away. And we do that for security reasons. What happens is that we find out that there's a match, but we are careful not to, we the information is still encrypted. So I should say our whole system is end-to-end encrypted. So it's very secure and very safe. And we still can't see the perpetrator or the survivor's information, personal information. What we do then is assign that case to a advocate, a survivor advocate who is trained in trauma-informed care, and they reach out to the survivors separately. The survivor has a choice of whether or not to meet with that person. If they choose to meet with that person, they'll set up a Zoom call and they will talk about what happened to them for the first time. And then they will go over their options. So, what's a criminal option based on what happened? What's a civil option? What's a Title IX option? What are mental health options? What would happen legally if you blasted your perpetrator's name on social media? Whatever the case may be, whatever you're curious about. What happens if you went through a Title IX process and you didn't get the result that you wanted? Whatever the case may be. And then if it's safe to do so and you know your risks and you agree, that advocate will put the survivors in contact so they can pursue healing and justice, whatever that means for them. So we are agnostic about reporting. We do not investigate what happened. We do not report to police, Title IX, or HR. We are really about empowering those survivors to make the best decision for themselves. And if you think back to the Me Too movement, which, the day that we're recording is the anniversary, the 8-year anniversary of Me Too going viral. But if you look back to that, it was journalists doing this work. So a journalist would, for Harvey Weinstein, it was Jodi Kantor and Megan Twohey, and they found all of these survivors. And one of the things that they say in their book, She Said, was that if these survivors are going to jump, they have to know they're going to jump together. And in many ways, that's what happened. But those survivors had to use their name. They had to have somebody who knew about them. And there's a lot of hate that comes with publicly putting your name out there. We both know Jess Michaels, an Epstein survivor, who, if you go to her social media, you can see the hate that she gets for telling her story publicly. And so, what we're trying to do is to replace that, where survivors can find out in a very confidential way if their perpetrators harm somebody else, because at times it just helps with healing. One of the things that Jess has said, and she has given me permission to use this story, is that she thought she was the only Epstein survivor for 30 years. And when she saw his picture in the Miami Herald, that was the day her healing began, because that was the day she realized that she wasn't the only one and that all of the tactics that he did were indeed grooming and it wasn't her fault. She could not control what happened. And so I think that there's a level of healing that happens when you connect survivors. And then we can see with Harvey Weinstein, with Bill Cosby, with Larry Nassar, with all of these high-profile perpetrators, that there's strength in numbers of accountability. And I wish there didn't have to be, but that is the case right now. And that so that is really why we exist, because these systems are not working. They're not helpful. They're even worse for people of color, LGBTQ folks, immigrants, and people who don't trust law enforcement. And so we have a way to help them heal in a different way and help them seek services in a different way that, like you said, we're the only technology in the world that is really doing this work.
Speaking of Jess Michaels, in earlier this year, she did an interview with Metro UK, and one of the quotes in the article is, quote, "Every single perpetrator wants us to think we're the only one." Jess told Metro, quote, "I really believe Callisto could be a huge game changer in this epidemic." I couldn't think of a better way to put that because, my perpetrator, I was not the only one. And I also agree, mine didn't happen on a college campus. Mine didn't happen on, like anything else. It was in my own like private space. But I think it's a game changer in the technology world. And the way that technology continues to evolving, our systems also need to evolve, or we're going to continue being further behind in the times. If you look at other aspects across the world, there are things that are more advanced in the US. However, again, there is nothing else like Callisto outside of maybe like one or two other aspects of it, but it's not as complex as Callisto is, and it addresses the whole issue, not just certain parts of it. Not that addressing those certain parts isn't crucial, but we need to look at the whole picture here. So I love the work that Callisto is doing. You're continuing on the incredible success of Callisto. And, you know, it's a deep honor to sit down and talk with you. Now, what have you heard as like review wise about the Callisto Vault? And what have you heard survivors saying?
It has been amazing to hear survivors. So because of our level of encryption, we don't know who uses our system, and we don't always know who matches. And then sometimes they reach out to us after they've matched. And there's one survivor in particular who you can read their account of this on our website. They anonymously spoke out about what it was like for them to match. And basically what happened was that their partner at the time assaulted them. And so this survivor went to a party, got drunk, had her partner take her home, thought that it was the right thing to do. And the person assaulted her in the middle of the night. And that survivor thought that they were the only one. And they matched in Callisto 2 years after the assault, and then eventually found multiple people on their campus that had been assaulted by this same perpetrator, and they reported to Title IX, and their healing changed. They knew they were the only one, or they weren't the only one, and they knew that they were drinking wasn't what made them responsible for their assault, that this person had done it to numerous people. And I think that that is what it means. And we've surveyed our users, and 75% of them say that they've improve their emotional well-being just from using the system, not even from matching. And 90% say that they feel more secure just knowing that technology like Callisto exists because there's hope. When the binary is report or don't report, and that is such a difficult binary, especially when some people do make the choice to report and nothing happens with it. There's another option that can lead to more hope and to lead to the fact that an organization and technology even exists to answer that question of, am I the only one, can be completely profound for certain survivors.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and looking through the projectcallisto.org, you know, there's a ton of resources on here, like definitions, should I report, forensic exams, find support, survivor's guide, help a friend. I think this is incredibly important. And the survivor's guide is very complex. And looking at the survivor's guide, if I would have saw something like this, it would have been a total game changer. And I have to agree. I think that this is very game-changing technology. And the description under the survivor's guide is, after sexual assault, campus survivors face unique challenges. In partnership with Me2 International, we have designed this comprehensive and interactive guide to help survivors understand their rights and access the support they deserve. And then below that, there's also an allies guide. Because it's oftentimes asked, how can I be a better ally? How can I be an ally to survivors? How can I be an ally to these organizations that are doing the work on the ground to amplify the survivors' voices? You start by believing. And looking at these guides, I think it's incredible. It's incredible to see. So I just, you know, I'm just the biggest fan of Callisto in general. And I actually found out about Callisto through one of my co-founders, Mercedes. Mercedes Malloy is one of my co-founders, and she walked me through what Callisto is doing, and that created that partnership because I believe in, you know, this work. And going through there's just so much happening in the world right now. So what is, you know, in the future, what is Callisto aiming to continue doing? Obviously, with like grant funding, you know, coming to a screeching halt and a number of, you know, other tumultuous things going on, where can you see Callisto going and how can people directly contribute to that? And then we'll kind of dive in a little bit more into different ways that people can get involved, different ways to do things, and, you know, kind of talk a little bit more about your experience. And I have some other questions too, but what can you see happening in the world of, well, let's put it directly how it is, like censorship. I mean, we see that the Jeffrey Epstein files are still being hidden, right? We still see a lot of a number of other things happening too. What can you see? What do you see going on?
I mean, can you imagine if those Epstein survivors had access to this technology in 1991, in 1995, where they could come together before they individually reported to the police and to the FBI and nothing happened, before it got to this level? Like, that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to prevent so many sexual assaults from happening and supporting those that have already experienced that sexual assault. And, you know, our work is really complex. It's not easy to discuss. It's not easy to say, here's a soundbite of what our technology does. And so there's a lot of challenges in that, but we have thought through so much of the ins and outs of there's lists that happen all the time, right? There was in during the Me Too era, there was the shitty men of media. I think it was the shitty media men list or something like that. And it was shut down. And the owner of that list was sued for defamation, and she lost. And so, because of how our technology is so encrypted, we have given survivors a different option for that. And I might need you to repeat that question a little bit, because I feel like I got a little off track, because there's just so much I can say. But I will also say, of like, I was trying to leave gender-based violence work because I had done it for so long, and it's really, really heavy work. And I didn't feel like we were making progress in solutions. Like, the treatment for survivors has progressed. It's gotten so much better, the different types of therapies, the understanding of it. Me Too is definitely a watershed moment. And yet we're not doing anything. The prevention stuff isn't really there. Like, a lot of times what we call prevention is covering your drink at a bar, don't run by yourself, all of those things. Those are our risks. Like, those are individual risk reducers. They're not prevention, because what that perpetrator is doing at the bar is saying, oh, okay, I'm not going to rape that person. I'm not going to rape that person. But that person doesn't have their drink covered, so I'm going to rape that person. So it doesn't change the amount of assaults happening. It just changes your own individual risks if you participate or if you do those things. And those things are not bad to do. Like, they're absolutely not bad to do. But also, if you don't do them, then it's an immediate victim blaming situation. So I was trying to get out of this work. And when I had the opportunity to become the CEO of Callisto almost 4 years ago, I took it because I knew that this was the game changer. After all the years of work that I've done, I knew that this technology can make a difference because of the amount of people who have said, I wonder if he did it to anybody else throughout my 25 years, and how many times I've worked with perpetrators who they have offended multiple people. And even now, when I tell people about Callisto, there's typically a pause. And then after the pause, I get a, I wish we had this when I was in college. And here's the thing, is that if you have an alumni account, it doesn't matter who the perpetrator is. You can put in any perpetrator. They don't have to be associated with the school either. And so we've opened that up. So I guess going back to the original question, now that I remember it, is that we want more and more survivors to have access to it. Yes, we want to solve campus sexual assault, but we know that sexual assault is not solely a campus issue. That is just where we started. And we really want to expand to figure out how to get more and more people access and to somehow monetize that access without charging survivors. So that way we're more stable, because funding in this space is extremely challenging. But so we are looking for people who really want to invest in this technology beyond college campuses and to help us do a pilot. To be able to figure out how we can best expand and how we can best get this technology all over the US and all over the world.
I'm speechless because I'm trying to find the words that I can say about how incredibly important it is to continue expanding, but it's also very expensive. So anyone out there, you can donate directly to Callisto and it'll be on our website very soon. It'll be, doing our own donation and things like that. And I think it's incredibly important to continue advocating for the important resources like Callisto. Now, Tracy, I want to pivot really quickly. And you mentioned about Title IX earlier. So, Title IX, the 1972 federal law prohibiting sex-based discrimination in any education program or activity receiving federal funding, protecting students and staffer discrimination and ensuring equal opportunity in academics and athletics. However, that sounds great on like wording. We know oftentimes this is still a very flawed law and flawed policy. And oftentimes college campuses across the United States do not follow a lot of what they're required to follow. Now, thinking about that, August of 2024, there was new guidelines that came forth from the Biden-Harris administration stating about adding LGBTQ protections and sexual orientation, gender identity, and gender expression under protected under Title IX. However, an Eastern, or I think it was a Eastern or Southern Kentucky federal judge overturned those additions to the Title IX earlier this year in January. Now, Callisto is one of the alternatives to, or one of the alternatives of not reporting directly to police or Title IX. But what are you seeing in like the Title IX world and why this is even more important to recognize Callisto and the work that Callisto is doing in this deteriorating Title IX policy? Because with the potential elimination of the Department of Education, it sets a really dangerous precedent to the country.
Yeah. I think Title IX can be really confusing. And to be honest, because I'm not a lawyer, I don't fully understand it either, you know? And I think that it's what is Title IX? You know, you're an 18-year-old college student. What is Title IX? And then you read that and it says nothing about sexual assault. And so it is really confusing and it's not always helpful. And every 4 to 8 years, those policies change because it changes with the administration. And so there's different guidelines that come up. And so the schools are often confused. And there's really good folks that are working in those systems that can't do what they want to do. And so a lot of times survivors like don't want the person to go to jail. They want to not have to sit next to them in class. And that can be something that Title IX helps with, but Title IX also doesn't want to do like a whole investigation. They do at times, but a lot of times they don't. Or if the assault happened in an apartment off of campus, they no longer have jurisdiction to that. And so there's so many complex things about Title IX, and that's why we want to give people an alternative. Also, like less than 10% of people report to Title IX or to the police. And so there's a variety of reasons for that. A lot of times it's because even if they do, they're not getting justice. But we wanted to give not even an alternative because you can do both. You know, we want a yes and. But it's more of a supplement to Title IX. When Title IX doesn't work, or even if Title IX does work, but you think that other people may not have wanted to go through that process and you want to find them because you went through it and it worked out well for you. There's that possibility too. And again, a lot of people don't even know it exists on a college campus. I wasn't aware of it when I was on college and it existed then. And so I think having different alternatives is really important, particularly right now when if you have a student visa and you're worried about that right now. You're not going to report a sexual assault to Title IX because you're going to risk that. You're going to be silenced. You're going to live with that pain. But you know what? If you can at least enter into matching and maybe you find a match, and then maybe you know that somebody else is going to report because they have your support. And that is what we're doing. Or if you're a trans student and you don't want to deal with the school system at all, you just want to study, again, we have that for folks who get even less out of these systems.
Exactly. And I've always been told that those that are closest to the problem have the best solutions. And I think Callisto recognizes that incorporating the survivor voice into the work that you're doing is so incredibly crucial and so incredibly important. And that survivor led or survivor focus, like I think it's so incredibly crucial to recognize the
We
need to
do,
continue advocating.
yeah, we do everything survivor centered, trauma informed and survivor centered. And I think those become buzzwords, For people, but because I've been doing this work for so long and I'm a licensed clinical social worker by training, I know what trauma-informed means. And I know what being survivor-centered means. And sometimes we are so survivor-centered, we prevent ourselves from getting funding because survivor-centered is not collecting any data, right? The less amount of data you collect, the less amount of risk there is to that getting out there. But we can't not collect data and get funding, right? So we think about every time of like, okay, if we collect these demographics, how are we using that? How is it going to impact survivors? How do we know that? You know, and if we don't have an answer for that, we're not doing it. And so we do collect demographics, but those demographics are not connected to the entries at all. Like there's no way in our system to connect those entries, and we only get that in aggregate. And so that poses challenge because we can't see what one user does all the way through, like a lot of technology. Usually you can map the path of a user. And we can't do that because we are so survivor-centered that we don't want to be able to do that because that puts survivors more at risk. And we've talked about that a lot. And maybe someday we'll change that when we have the answer to do that and when we have the exact reason to do that. And we continually make upgrades and changes along the way. To make sure that we can serve the most survivors in the safest way possible, but we also make sure to do informed consent in not in legalese either. Like we do it in a way that somebody who's experiencing trauma can really understand what we're saying and what it means to use our system. And we're going to constantly improve that with feedback and with everything else because I can't read the legalese stuff. And you know, most of the time you get a privacy policy and you're just like, yep, whatever. And you don't even know what you're clicking to. Well, we want to make sure that you know, and it is written in a way that you can fully understand what you're agreeing to or not agreeing to. Like we have a consent portal in our system because we think that consent is so important that we want to be able to survey survivors anonymously. But you may not want to receive that email because it might be too triggering for you. And so you have the ability to opt out of that if you don't want to do that. And so we make sure that here is your consent portal. You know exactly where to find it. It is right on the dashboard and it's really easy to find.
I think it's incredible. I really do. I think it's beyond incredible. And I think it's leaving a lasting legacy, and that's going to continue going on. And sustainability in this space is so incredibly hard to, focus on like a big picture, whenever it seems like every time the country takes steps forward, we take like 1,000 steps backwards. And, seeing a lot of this funding and seeing a lot of the service providers across the country like deeply being impacted by the funding cuts. I know Callisto has seen that. I know it's incredibly hard. And people are wondering, like, where can I donate to? How can I contribute? What can I do? And I think that's incredibly important for an organization like Callisto that also relies on, those small donors and like the individual donors. I think, I think it's incredibly crucial for people to donate to these services and these organizations that are literally changing the game in the world of sexual and gender-based violence prevention, but also focusing on that postvention, because the way that Callisto's platform is, it's prevention, but it's also the postvention, because it's giving that knowledge that, hey, this perpetrator wasn't just me. There's also XYZ, and then who's to say that my next door neighbor couldn't be the next one, or my best friend couldn't be the next one. So I think it's also like that postvention part too.
Absolutely.
And it's not a way of dragging down the survivors as some other organizations do, not, calling out names, but there are organizations out there that like to amplify survivors' voices, but it's more like exploitation versus the actual addressing the main issue here, right?
Yeah,
So
absolutely.
can you talk a little bit about like that part without, obviously, without naming organizations and et cetera, there are organizations that do exploit survivors' voices and
Yes.
uses it in a negative context and likes to twist the narrative. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. Having done this work for so long,
You've seen it.
I've seen it, I fought against it, and I won't do it. And which is makes fundraising more challenging. So, there's local programs that typically have a luncheon, right? So if they're a local domestic violence shelter, local rape crisis center, any local nonprofit, even beyond GBV, has a luncheon, and you get somebody that has used your services to come up and speak. And you feel like the people doing that, off, like, sometimes the survivors feel that sense of empowerment, right? And the people watching go, oh, that's a really great story, and it prompts me to give. But there's a lot of survivors that don't fully grasp what that means to put their experience out into the world and what they're going to be experiencing after that. And so I've had numerous survivors of high profile people approach me and say, I want to do something. I want to raise awareness for what you're doing. And I say, great. I want survivors' voices to be included. I never want to feel like you have to be exploited. Once you put your story out there, I cannot take it back. I can take it off the website, but I cannot take back all the copies. I want to make sure that you know why you're doing this. I want to make sure you're in therapy and you have support or have done a lot of therapy, so you know that this is going to hit differently, because every survivor that has told their story has some kind of feelings afterwards, good and bad at the same time. Sometimes all good, some are, mostly good, sometimes mostly bad, but they have those feelings, and I want to make sure that they're prepared for them, because we need to understand this without having to hear survivor stories. This should not have to be on the backs of survivors to talk about a horrific event in order for somebody to be compelled to give. That's why we need to believe survivors. We need to believe the numbers. We need to believe the women and men and trans and non-binary folks who have saying that this happened to me. And so, like Jess Michaels shares about Callisto all the time, and she is a dear friend of mine, and we have had numerous conversations about it, and we continually have conversations about checking in of like, are you okay with this? Are you sure you're still okay with me sharing your experience? Are you sure you're okay with all of this? And it's constant ongoing consent. We continually practice that, because I've just seen it go awry, and I never want a survivor to regret speaking out for an organization or feeling indebted to an organization, because we're there to support survivors. Survivors don't need to share their story to support us. That being said, we do rely on individual donations. They are super important to us. They're nearly 50% of our funding. Because of the data issue, we can't always get traditional funding because we don't have the data. Particularly right now, a lot of foundations do not want to invest in new technology because they're scared. They don't want to make a bad investment. They want to do what works. There's so many other organizations right now that are losing funding because of federal funding cuts, because of the shutdown, because of everything else. And this statistic, like, floors me every time I think about it. In all of philanthropic funding in the US, so all of money that's given to charity, less than 2% goes to women and girls issues. That includes reproductive rights. That includes breast cancer research. So if you think about all the pink ribbons with Susan G. Komen, which is incredibly important work, it goes to Girls Who Code. It goes to Girl Scouts. It goes to any nonprofit that is dealing with women and girls, less than 2%. Gender-based violence is even smaller, and sexual assault of adult people is very small as well. And you add in organizations that are supported by Black women, and it's even smaller. And so we need more awareness to this issue. We need more awareness to the resources, because these are not things that people want to share. They're not, people don't, we've had survivors find our page and say, I want to follow you, but it's too much. I can't handle the comments that are negative. I can't handle like this coming up on my feed when I'm having a good day, but I love the work you're doing and continue to do it, right? And so it is hard for us to gain traction. And so, I would love for your followers, if they have the capacity, to follow us on Instagram at Callisto, to share, to like, to, repost everything. All of that significantly helps our traction on social media, because Meta platforms don't typically want to share us. We get blocked for being political when we're not political. We get blocked for being inappropriate content because how do you talk about rape and sexual assault without it flagging some filter? And again, survivors don't always want to be the ones to share it. So donating $5 can really, really, really help, you know? And again, our individual donations range from $2 to $200,000, by each individual, and every one of it we are appreciative for. And I will also say that last year, we nearly closed our organization. We thought we were done. We had announced our closure, and survivors said, I'm going to get choked up just thinking about this. Survivors said, absolutely not. They knew that they needed the resource. And when people thought the resource was going away, they were willing to step up and donate. And it was overwhelming and amazing. And a year later, we're still here. We're still trucking. We're going to expand. Yet we need that kind of momentum every day. Every day. Because that crisis, what people saw externally was a moment in time crisis. But the thing is that Callisto and organizations that are supporting survivors are in a crisis every day, just like survivors, in many ways. Not always. I don't want to compare our suffering or anything to survivors, but in particularly in 2025, there is a crisis for funding every day. And the more that you can give, if you can give $5 a month, that adds up. Those monthly donors are like people that we can count on, is incredible. And do what you can. And if you can't do it, make a, you know, try to get your family and friends to do it. Create a fundraiser page. It's all laid out on our website. You can email us, contact@projectcalisto.org, in order to get more information about it. But all of that support helps, and spreading the word about us helps, particularly for those people with EDUs.
Yeah. Yes. Everything that you just said, absolutely spot on, 100%. And I think, speaking from a survivor perspective, I find resources like Callisto so incredibly important to continue amplifying. And I, Tracy, thank you so much for coming on the podcast today. I cannot thank you enough for the work that you and your team do, your board of directors, all of your everybody that's involved in Callisto, which is just a beautiful group of human beings. And I am deeply inspired by you. I look up to you as one of my role models and as somebody who I can just look at whenever I feel like we can't keep going because this world wants to silence voices like mine and like Jess Michaels and my co-founders Gwen, Amelia, and Mercedes wants to silence our voices, but also my mom. I've seen what these systems have done to my mom. I've seen what continues to perpetuate violence against people like my mom, who is a disabled woman who, at any moment can become re-victimized because she is a survivor herself. I think about that on a daily basis, but I also think about her cancer diagnosis. You mentioned about like breast cancer. Hers is not breast cancer, it is stage 3 cervical cancer. However, that cancer research can still help her. And whenever that funding is cut, who knows what the hell's going to happen next? It's a lot of that gray area. And it's a lot like the redacted Jeffrey Epstein files, where it just has like this like black line that goes across, and it blocks out a lot of these key players and key important parts.
And what we don't know is the long on like ongoing impacts of this, of like these organizations that are shutting down. There's a hole in those communities, and there's going to be a hole for a long time. And then building that back is even harder. Not to mention with the executive order for the DEI language, right? Some of the words that you're not allowed to use in research right now, or to be able to get grant funding, are women, victims, and trauma. What is that going to do in 5 years from now when there's been no grants and no research around this, right? And so we can do, when we get bigger and when more people are using us, we're going to have the data in a very different type of way. and to be able to hold perpetrators accountable. Like right now, we're focused on survivors of helping support them in their healing because perpetrator accountability takes a long time. So in 5 years, we're going to have more data about perpetrator accountability as we see the matches increase, as we see all of that, and then we're going to get to policy change. And we can continue to do all of that with these other systems breaking and failing and changing, and those typical ways of doing some of that stuff. And the doing that research for policy change isn't happening right now, but we can do that in a different way, and we can get to that policy change. And the more money we have to do it, the quicker we can get there. The quicker we can get awareness for it, the quicker we can grow, the quicker we can get more people using it, the quicker we can get more matches to help more survivors, to hold more perpetrators accountable and get to that policy change. But that is a 10-year process. Maybe 20. You know, I hope it could be 5. I hope it could be 2, but this is a long-term problem that we need a long-term solution for.
Exactly, because it's been a long-standing issue in our communities for decades. Decades and decades and decades of research has been conducted. And I also hear that what, this dangerous precedent that we're headed down, I think the research is, oh God, it's going to look so different. But I can't even find the words to even explain like how I feel right now. And I know like so many others feel that way too. And what is, I guess it's like my last question, Tracy. What is something that you have shared with others to keep advocating and to keep fighting, keep pushing back? Like, what's that word of advice that you give to people who are wanting to get involved, who are wanting to make a change? What would you tell them and why?
It is a super marathon. It is not a sprint. I have been doing this work for 25 years. I've watched a lot of really good people burn out because they're like, we need these changes. We need these changes. You have to celebrate the smallest of glimmers. We talk about the triggers all the time, but we need to celebrate the smallest of glimmers. I put on my LinkedIn page because our director of programs and strategic engagements went and spoke with a fraternity in Atlanta, and watching, like her smile, Sharefa's smile in the picture with these group of young men wanting to talk about this is a glimmer. It is, and there were probably about 25 of them, and that fueled me. And we want those big movements. We want the Me Too movement. We want these big wins. And yes, we need to push those, but there were so many small movements that I can count to that got to Me Too. Tarana Burke started it in 2006. It went viral in 2017. It took a long time of different campaigns and different things that have happened. And so patience, and it's so hard, particularly if you're a survivor, to have patience because you want justice and healing now. But the Epstein survivors are a testament to all of us of like, I hope someday they will get justice. But 30 years ago, they didn't think that they were going to. They didn't even think it was an opportunity. They didn't even think that that was a possibility. And now here they are being able to use their voices. And so find the hope. Take a breath. One of the things that I've been saying too, and I learned this from the HIV movement in the 80s and 90s of, and I saw this on a TikTok of, they talked about how in the morning they buried their friends, in the afternoon they protested, and at night they danced. And I think that is such a beautiful, beautiful thing to remember for any activist. And I know that these sexual assault is intersectional with racial justice, is intersectional with LGBTQ justice. It's intersectional with every type of justice. And so we can learn from that movement to say, we also need to laugh. We also need to have fun because that prevents burnout, and it helps us keep going, and it is necessary. I make sure that my staff take vacation. I make sure that I take vacation because it makes us do our job better. And so, for all of you amazing advocates who follow your page and follow this podcast, keep doing what you're doing, but also take a breath. and take care of yourselves too, because that is just as important.
Absolutely. Tracy, thank you so much for coming on the Rise for Justice Movement podcast. And anybody out there who wants to donate, you can go to projectcalisto.org and go to the give section. You can hit donate, create a fundraiser, or contact them for other ways to give and get involved. Also follow them on social media. State or Tracy, what was your Instagram handle?
At Callisto.
Perfect. All right, Tracy, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. I greatly appreciate you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Of course. Thank you.